Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Hospital for Children, offering primary, specialty, and critical care for all children, from the smallest babies to the biggest teenagers. For more information or to learn about their specialty outpatient locations throughout the state, the number is 1-800-492-5538. Or you can just log on to steinershow.org, and their University of Maryland Medical System banner is up there. Click on that, and there's tons of information there as well. We have another one of our Urbanite Radio stories, Urbanite Radio Conversations, happening today. That story today, it was an article written by Greg Hanscom. He interviewed the author Ethan Waters on, and it was called Defining a Generation, author Ethan Waters on Urban Tribes, the Tea Party Movement, and the Dark Matter that Holds Cities Together. So he joins us by phone here today, and we have in the studio Dr. Chris Marsh, who is Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of Maryland, who wrote some really controversial and groundbreaking research we had on the show a few months back about how young single African-American women are changing the notion of what it means to be middle class in America. And so Ethan Waters and Chris Marsh, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Let me slide that mic a little closer to you, Chris. Ethan, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Hi, Ethan.
Hello.
So these generational things are always so interesting to me, in terms of what happens in a society that makes behavior different from one generation to the other. It makes things switch. I thought my generation back in the 60s, the early 70s, was the non-marrying generation for a while. We had thrown the entire country open to new things. But this generation is very different, one's coming behind us. And Ethan, talk a bit about, from your perspective, starting with you, what it is about this world that people 40 and under are growing up in that changes the way people relate to their lives.
Yeah, it's really a fascinating and very fast cultural shift we've seen. I mean, the 1950s was the youngest marrying age in American history, and then it was followed by the boomers who delayed a little bit. Now the Gen Xers are really gone out on the edge in terms of delaying marriage. They've taken a long time, and then that's especially if you're college educated, if you move to an urban center after college, you tend to delay marriage for anywhere from 5, 10 to 15, or in my case, 20 years after college, you delay marriage. And this is, and I think a lot of us at that time looked at ourselves in the mirror and got really anxious about it and thought, what is wrong with me? And it was only when I began to look around at my generation and say, hey, it's not only me. Something else is happening here, because there's a huge cohort of this population, this generation, that is delaying marriage. So it can't just be my looks or my attitude or my, dating style. It must be something else. So I went out and I began to look for what that thing was. And not only that, but try to make a justification for the time I was spending outside of a family and what it meant. Who was it benefiting? Was it simply a matter of being selfish? Was it just like the Friends TV show in Seinfeld? Were we just sort of self-absorbed people making our way through urban centers? And I believe it's much more than that. I believe that we are devoting ourselves to our friendship groups in a way that is very lovely and very full of life and full of meaning. And I wanted to help give that a name and help define what that thing was. So that's why I called these things the urban tribes and tried to tell stories about them that would give people hope and meaning.
You relate to that, Chris Marsh?
I agree with Ethan completely. I've looked at census data for African-American women in particular. And for those that are single and living alone, where I might venture off a little different than Ethan is that they're not necessarily delaying marriage. They're actually foregoing marriage. They're actually not marrying. So there's been some data to suggest that people are marrying later in life, and that is in fact the case. But there's also a cohort out there that's not marrying at all, and that's particularly pronounced among single and living alone Black women.
So why – I'm curious. I want to get underneath this for a moment with both your perspectives. The why. What is it – I mean, you can look – there's been so many studies about what happened in the 1960s, why people behaved the way they did in the 60s and 70s, what each generation faced and why they responded to society in America the way they did. And I'm curious what you both think is – what are the societal, social pushes? What are the economic – pressures or whatever they might be, sense of family, different. Why did it happen? What were the dynamics in society that led to this different perspective on waiting for marriage or even not getting married?
So I came down to two things. I'm very interested to hear what Chris says. Well, my two things were, the central things, was one, Gen Xers grew up in families with high divorce rates. So this was the 70s and 80s, and marriages were failing all over the place. So I think there was a little more trepidation about the very idea of marriage, because in all likelihood, or in one in two of them, the marriages of their parents didn't make it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one. And then the second thing I think is really critical is this is the first generation where women were really had educational opportunities, and not only had educational opportunities, but had the potential to do graduate work and had the potential to have real careers when they hit the city. And that so that critically delayed that gap between, in older generations, certainly in most of human history, women went from a family to a family. And now suddenly there was a real gap. There was a college gap, and then there was a career gap. And that meant that women spent some time alone. And I think while they spent that time alone, they often formed these very meaningful friendship groups. And so suddenly marriage wasn't just the next obvious thing. They had to weigh marriage against the thing they had, which was a meaningful friendship group with a meaningful career or a viable career. And suddenly marriage might not, they certainly wouldn't, go with the first person who happened to show up. They were going to weigh this institution and this relationship against something real that they already had going in their lives. And I think oftentimes the relationship just didn't quite measure up to the thing that they had going. And so I think it's fundamentally about women having this time of life that spurred the marriage delay and then spurred these urban tribes. And then that itself has its own momentum in people's lives.
I have to agree with you wholeheartedly, Ethan. Mm. What I might add to the discussion, though, is labor force participation. As you have more women in the labor force, they may not see the need to necessarily marry because they're able to sustain themselves economically without a partner. So for black women in particular, they're like, okay, so we're in the labor force, we're professional. Do we want to, at this point, get married? And do we have men that we can marry that are on the same educational level as us, have the same kind of occupation, the same kind of income? So then there becomes a question among black women in particular, are there viable men out there for them to marry? So if they do decide to marry later in life and they've spent more time in their friendship networks than they do in a family, going straight from family to family, do they have someone that they can actually now start to develop a family with? And that becomes a kind of like a question that's been asked in the sociological literature over and over again. Is it that there's a marriage market issue for black women? Is that why they're not getting married?
Is it?
There could be.
that's a very politic answer.
I think that's one part of the discussion. But I also think that black women at some point are making decisions to say, I'm not sure that this is what I want to do right now. There's some other things that I want to do, including working, going to graduate school, that kind of stuff. And because of that, I think that they're saying, okay, I don't have to get married now. And then when they do have all of the accolades, they don't have comparable mates to choose from. So I think that there is something there.
So is that markedly different from, Ethan, how you look at life?
Well, I think there's a very similar thing, and I think the most interesting cohort of the urban tribes that I'm talking about, I mean, I wrote about this at the end of my single life. So I was, 38 at the time, and I had just gotten engaged, and now I'm the father of three children. Several years later after I wrote that book, I'm the father of three children. But there is a cohort of my urban tribe that stayed single, and it was by and large the women. So the women, just like I did, rode this time from their 20s to their late 30s in this vibrant urban tribe. And then there is sort of a cruel truth of the marriage market, that women at 40 or 42 have a harder time finding the mate than the man at 40 or 42. Men have, I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong or saying something that's impolitic, but they have a larger age range to choose from. And I ended up, for myself, I married someone 7 years my junior, and there were many of the women who were my friends during those urban tribes who have not found a mate and have not started families. So there is some biology here at play and some social, mating market ideas here at play that oftentimes do not. I'm not to say not favor the women, because I think really the interesting thing is that you know, my whole idea behind Urban Tribes is take some responsibility for the story you tell about your life. And I think the women who are now really at the forefront for making a new narrative about what it is like to live a vibrant, wonderful, you know, fulfilled life outside of a marriage, perhaps, or outside of a traditional family, are indeed the women who I think that Chris documents, both you know, both minorities and non, who are in their 40s and coming up on their 50s, who have not found families or marriages, but there is a wonderful story to tell, and that's when you need to step up and start telling the story, because I think if we don't have a story to tell ourselves about our lives or our generation, we tend to get very anxious, and it tends to cause us a lot of anxiety.
This is interesting. There's something that the two of you raise in different ways here. I wonder if part of the dynamic that's going on is something that really stands on the head, the old wives' tale sense that men not wanting to be married because they didn't want to get married. There's always reluctance to get married. No, I really want to do this. No, I don't want to do this. I want to be free. I want to be alone. I don't want to be married. And that's part of the mythology, not complete mythology either, obviously. It really happens about marriage. But what you both are pointing out now is that in some ways, maybe part of this is defined by the self-realization of younger women who have become professionals, who are making a life for themselves, that marriage is less important than it was. And it's the women saying, maybe I don't want to be married just yet. Maybe I don't want to be in this kind of relationship just yet. Maybe I have my own growing to do. Maybe it's women in some ways fueling this more than men, fueling the change in attitude of a generation.
But that's a really interesting point that you raise, Mark, because I wonder if the women at some point wanted to get married and wanted to have children, wanted to have this quintessential married couple, family, household. And for whatever reason, it didn't happen when they thought it was going to happen. So they executed a plan B, plan B being college, graduate school, so on and so forth. And so then they said, since it seems as if it's not happening that I'm getting married and having a mate and children, let me go ahead and try to redefine this. And let me try to make it something different. And let me try to kind of embrace it. So I wonder if it's a forced position that they're in, or if it's really a choiced position that they're in.
Well, that's just a matter of perspective, because you do tend to look back at your life and layer a story onto the events, and your life in retrospect looks much more self-determined than I think it is going forward. I think we're much more at the swimming in currents that we can't perceive, currents of culture and our generation. And I do think that we don't tend to look back and regret the things we don't have, that hopefully we look at our lives and we tell a story about how we're in control of it, how this, what I'm doing, is meaningful. And I don't think there will be many women who are in the situation we're talking about, who are in their late 40s or 50s, not married perhaps, or not having children, who are going to ultimately just be overcome with regret. I think they're going to do remarkable things. But I do think it does help to have social stories that we tell ourselves about the demographic group that we're in, because I do think we reflect those. And if we don't tell those stories ourselves, someone comes along and tells them for us. And that is, in my sort of cohort, it was the Friends TV show, as I mentioned, and the Seinfeld. And they were telling me stories about my group that were really stories that were ultimately funny, but not very uplifting in terms of what these characters were doing with their lives. And so I decided to take a little control myself and tell a different story.
So this is interesting. I mean, so far, two things have come out, and we'll come back to them. One has to do with what you said earlier, Ethan, about the people growing up in a world of divorces. Whether you grew up in a home that was divorced, you knew families that grew up in homes that were divorced, and maybe there are a lot of homes that are not divorced that some of the kids wish they were divorced. So I mean, that dynamic is part of it, and the other is where that this next generation after the feminist revolution of the 60s and 70s found themselves in a place that was very markedly different than their mothers and their grandmothers. And I wonder how you two think that is changing the dynamic of what we think of as family in the coming years? How will that change what we think of as family? Will it?
Well, I think this, you know, I think the idea of marriage is, I think a lot of people looked at this marriage lay and thought, uh-oh, this generation is skewing this fundamental institution that keeps us all together. And there was a lot of editorials and griping about how Generation X was turning away from marriage. And I think it's just, I don't think in the end they're turning away from marriage. I think there will be some people that do not get married, as we've been talking about. But I think there's been some interesting studies coming out that suggest that marriages that are started slightly later in one's life, not the marriages when you're 21, 22, but the marriages when you're 27, 28 or older, tend to be, at least the early statistics, tend to suggest, and Chris, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but tend to suggest that those marriages are doing a little bit better in terms of their longevity. So here's a generation that I think that's interesting that's been accused of turning away from marriage that I think actually may be bringing some meaning back to marriage. And the idea that, and I think it's important that if you have a vibrant career and a social life and a good group of friends, you're going to enter that marriage, in a sense, giving up a way of life that is working for you. And that means, I think, you're going to take that marriage a little more seriously. You're not doing it just because it's the next train out of town, like when you're, you know, many generations ago when you had to pick a mate when you were 18 or 19 or 20, and you better hope that some guy comes along during that time. Now you're actually making this choice. And I think because we're making that choice, we may indeed be revitalizing this institution that I do think is important for our society. And I would hope that that might be our legacy.
If I could dovetail what Ethan said, yes, as your age of marriage goes up, your divorce rate goes down. So there is a correlation. The older, if you marry older, you're more likely to stay married. Now, the issue about family, that's a really interesting question, because I wonder if, can a single living alone person be a family of one? It's food for thought. How do you actually define family? And speaking directly to Ethan's work, if you talk about these urban tribes, can they be now defined as a family?
I like to break that question down into sort of the component pieces of what does a family do? I mean, and you could say, for instance, well, many generations ago, or several, even a couple generations ago, a family vetted potential mates. They found mates for you, and they decided whether they were appropriate or good people for you to mate. Well, by and large, if you're 28 or 29 or 35 and living in a city, your family does not do that for you anymore, but your friends do, right? So there's an instance of friends taking over a role that families once did. So you can sort of begin to break all those things down and say, and I do think there is still sort of places where families do something that friends by and large don't do, and I would suggest serious medical illnesses. But what if you were to come down with cancer at 35 and could not take care of yourself, it is less likely that your friends are going to be able to effectively step in there for you, and more likely that you would still rely on those family, the family connections to help you at that point. That's not to say that never happened. Certainly in San Francisco and the AIDS epidemic, you had stories of remarkable sacrifices by friends. I do think a lot of the roles and the particular things that families once did have been more and more taken over by friendship groups as we've lived longer and longer a single life in the city. And I do think once you begin to see that and see the role of those friends, you can begin to say, answer Chris's question and say, yes, a single person living in a city can be part of a family, but you just have to slightly redefine family as not blood relatives.
Right.
410-319-8888. We're talking about a generation that's putting off marriage, the people 40 and under in America. What are the issues involved here? What is this generation saying to America? How will they redefine this country? How they might redefine family? Is it fueled by the divorce rates of parents? Is it fueled by the upside-down nature of the economy of America? We can talk a bit about that, too. Is it fueled by women finding a place that they never had before in society? Is it different in the black world and the white world? Is it different in different parts of our culture? 410-319-8888. What do you think? We are here with Ethan Waters. This is one of our Urbanite radio stories, where Urbanite radio interviews and conversations. Urbanite magazine had an article with Ethan Waters in this month's issue that was written by Greg Hanscom. It's called Defining a Generation, author of Ethan Waters on Urban Tribes, the Tea Party Movement, and the Dark Matter that Holds Cities Together. We'll talk about that dark matter in a bit and a little bit of Tea Party in this generation. And he wrote the book Urban Tribes, a Generation That Redefines Friendship, Family, and Commitment. Most recently, Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of American Psyche. And Dr. Chris Marsh is Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of Maryland, has been doing some really interesting research and work on black women as part of the new middle class, married or not. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Let's go right to the phones. A lot of people are calling in now. We'll see where in the age spectrum they may be and who they are. Well, you don't have to tell us that if you don't want to. D in Columbia, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can, D. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I just want to say two things. One is that from my observation, I think that African-American women marry for different reasons than why white women marry. African-American women marry generally, not all, but generally marry for more of a social step up. White women marry mainly for, you know, to have children or, you know, change the status. And then, you know, I have a lot of African-American friends. I was born and raised in West Africa, Liberia. I've seen a lot of white women go to Africa, get married, and bring their husbands over here. You know, so I offered this, you know, to my African-American single friends. I said, well, if you really, you know, want to marry, you know, a black man, why don't you fly to Haiti? Why don't you fly to Jamaica? why don't you fly to Africa? I mean, that's where the men are. But you know why they won't do it, Mark? It's because those men's earning potential is not all that high. And then white women are willing to overlook that, but you know, but black women are not, generally speaking. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dee. Chris, let me start with you and throw part of this to Ethan, but you start.
Well, Dee, I appreciate that you said in general terms, not all black women, because I don't think it is, in fact, the case that black women are only marrying for social reasons, and white women are marrying to have children. But I think he does raise a really interesting question. The whole notion of educational homogamy, for example, especially because I focus on middle class black women, those that are educated and are in professional occupations. Should a black woman want to marry someone who has the same educational level as her? Should she want to marry someone who has the same as maybe also a professional? And should that also be the same for white women? Or should white women be able to marry for one reason and black women should be able to marry for another reason? It's a really interesting question. I think Dee is on point. If you just simply want to be married, you can fly to Haiti and go and have yourself a husband. But I don't know what the long-term consequences of just having a husband means.
Ethan, I wonder if you think about it. I'm curious that the exploration of the idea that generationally, what motivates people, men or women, is different because of race in America.
It's a very difficult question because
it is.
Motivation just does not end up in. It's just a hard thing to count, you know. And when you're, when he was asking making that comment, I was thinking about my own life. I'm thinking about mostly the white women I knew, and I'm thinking, is that true that white women just marry for different reasons or not? And I have to say, you know, just anecdotally speaking, I was a freelance writer in San Francisco during the dot-com boom, where the largest creation of wealth in American history, and I was on the mating market competing with, guys that were just sort of falling into, millions of dollars. I have to say, it was kind of tough going there for a while for me. But then again, in the end, the end of my story is that I'm married a psychiatrist, someone who is vastly better educated than myself, vastly better sort of potential for a lifetime income. So either I lucked out or, there may be, again, something to be said for what he said.
I'm going to come back to this issue in another level because I think that perception about generations and who are friends and who lives in what worlds are very different, and I want to kind of explore that a bit too. But a lot of people are calling in. Let's see what they have to say at 410-319-8888. The next caller up is Ebony. You're on the air. Hi, Ebony, you there?
Hi, yes, I'm here.
Welcome.
Hi, thank you. And good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
I just wanted to comment specifically I'm a 30-year-old black female, and I know a lot of the issues concerning marriage are directly related to economics and also culture. Specifically in my age range, there are a lot of males that are immersed in the culture of, I guess, for lack of a better term, they're not really considering the future. So they're looking for short-term, quick money, and that kind of interferes with a lot of females in my age range. We're looking for more long-term stability. And, of course, with, you know, short-term things like that, there is really no consideration for long-term stability. So, I mean, I'm just speaking specifically in my age range, in my community. That's a big issue. A lot of our male counterparts aren't really thinking long-term for a number of different reasons.
Really interesting point. Chris?
Thank you, Ebony. That is a really great point that you bring up. I think to dovetail Ebony's point also is that if you have a sex ratio imbalance where you have more black women than you do black men who are not incarcerated, who are not homosexual, then you just have a simple numbers game where you have more women than you do men. So the question then becomes, do the men actually want to commit? Should they commit to one when they can have three or four or five? It's a thought question.
No, it's a thought question. You want to answer your thought question?
I don't have one. Well, it's a thought question for the whole panel.
Okay.
but I think there's some validity to that.
Yeah.
It's like I think there's some validity to that because you have a man who doesn't have – there's so many other options. There's some validity to that. But I think – but to be fair to black men, I think there are black men that do want to get married, are looking for a mate, and there are some, unlike the ones that Ebony might know, that really are looking kind of long term.
We're going to take a brief break here and come right back. You just heard Dr. Chris Marsh, assistant professor of sociology at the University of Maryland. Ethan Waters, who is part of Urbanite magazine, in an interview and author of Urban Tribes, his most recent book is Crazy Like Us. And we're talking about the generation that's putting off marriage, how it's changing the nature of society. I think it may be profoundly. We'll talk about that. How does race fit into it? Are things like Friends and the other things that kind of supposed to epitomize a generation only epitomize parts of it? Is this generation still as divided as the older generations, or is it not? 410-319-8888 is the number here. We'll come back to our callers. There'll be Lester, and who is next? Robin and Charisse, in that order. 410-319-8888. Stay with us. I'll be back in just a moment. Don't go away. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. We are talking about a generation, Generation X, generations 40 and under, and their change in attitude towards marriage, their own lives, and what it says about that generation, what it says about this country. This is one of our Urbanite Radio stories inspired by, in this month's issue, Greg Hanscom's interview with Ethan Waters, one of our guests, called Defining a Generation. Ethan Waters, of course, is the author of Urban Tribes, A Generation Redefines Friendship, Family, and the Government. His most recent book is Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. And Dr. Chris Marsh is assistant professor of sociology at the University of Maryland, who does a huge amount of research and writing around issues of women, especially African-American women, and marriage and their place in American society. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Let us go right to the phones, and I'll bring up the issues that I addressed before the break. And Lester, you're on the air.
Hey, what's up, Mark? How are you doing?
Dr. Lester Spence, excuse me.
There's only one. Hey, check this out. This is a really, really important issue. I just wanted to make a couple of a quick points
sure.
And ask a question.
Before you start, I have to out you just a minute here, Lester. When Chris, when you were on the show last, Lester was one of the people who wrote immediately, and we called me and said, I have to be on the show with Chris Marsh and have this conversation.
Okay.
And we'll plan that out for the first of the year.
Okay.
All right. Go ahead, okay. Lester.
Okay. So the point is that it's really important to understand that it's not just about worldview. That is, it's not just about whether somebody sees it in the long term or not. It's not just about age, but it's also about wealth. So the wealthier people tend to stay married longer, right? So that means that there are certain types of things that the institution of marriage does that benefits people who have money or have resources versus people who don't, right? So to that extent, it's not necessarily about race. It's about more about class. But this is the point. Let's say that you guys are absolutely right, that we're working towards a moment where the family doesn't do quite as much, and that there are a whole host of social networks that fill that role. Where does the state come in, right? So, for example, if my wife and I were prosecuted for something, my wife couldn't testify against me because she's my wife, right? If she all of a sudden becomes ill because she's my wife, I end up having to, there are certain types of benefits I have as far as visitation rights. And we could think about that not just horizontally, but also vertically. That is, I'm with my kids in a car now. If something happens to me, my kids get my stuff. How might government play a role in making the type of family structures that you guys call for more beneficial for the people who participate in them?
Interesting. Chris, I was watching your shaking your head, yes, no, mm-hmm. So I want you to answer first, because I can't see what Ethan was doing. I can't see what you were doing.
Okay. I want to take Lester's first point. I think it's interesting that he's suggesting that it's wealth, that wealth has something to do with people staying together. I might challenge him a bit or push him a bit and say, well, you also have to possibly understand that the older you are, the more resources you're going to have. You're not going to – coming out of college, I think we were all broke. So as you age, you acquire more things and you could acquire wealth. And so that – it might actually be age masked by wealth that is actually keeping the – marriages together. So something to just think about. I don't know if it's solely just wealth. So I'd caution him on that. The whole notion about state. That's a really interesting question. I don't have a well-articulated answer, but I do think that given books like Ethan's, given work that I'm doing, I think at some point we're going to have to start redefining family. It's not going to be married, single, widow, divorce.
Right.
And I think once we start to redefine things, then you'll have some kind of like legal rights. And I think that that's important. I think that's kind of the way that we're going.
Ethan, you want to jump into any of this?
Well, yeah, to change the government policy. And there are organizations out there that are trying to do this. And I've forgotten their names. But I went and visited one, I remember, while I was writing the book. It was Singles for America or something. And they were trying to rally the Singles for America to change those marriage laws and so forth that seem to benefit the married people. And the kind of sad thing about that organization is they just have a devil of a time getting membership. And I think that's because even though there are a lot of people out there who are single and living a long time and perhaps their entire lives this way, not many of that cohort wants to sign on as I am definitely single for the rest of my life. I mean, I think, and I'm curious about whether this is Chris's opinion, either anecdotally or statistically, but I think there's a lot of people out there who are single, who are living happy, meaningful lives. But I think also that idea of marriage and mate is so ingrained in our culture that I think even those people who are living very happy lives maybe reserve the possibility that maybe this year something was going to happen, something's going to break on that front, and I'll have a different opinion. So it's hard to get a big lobby behind that, let's change the marriage rules such that single people are treated equally, and they're certainly not treated equally now. But it's just hard to get that, get people to join that organization.
Lester, always good to hear from you, my friend, and we look forward to having you on the show very soon. As soon as the first year, I saw your name on the calendar, so I know you're coming on soon, and we'll get you on here with Chris March and talk about these issues of family as well. I want to ask you a question before we go back to the phone. So, folks, I'm going to come to your calls here, but. Two things. A was, I think the question of family is really interesting with this. A woman who's been on the show many times, her name is Dr. Stephanie Kuntz from Evergreen College, and she's written books like The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap, and many other books that she looks at family in America. And I mean, and the families are always being redefined. She wrote Marriage, a History as well. And it's never been the same. We think it's this little nuclear family, but it's never really been that way. And that's part of the mythology we built. And what you're talking about, Ethan, though, I think is the deep human desire to, for want of a better term at the moment, mate up, to be with somebody, and to build something around that. And I think that is also part of the human spirit, whether it's a long-term marriage or serial monogamy or whatever it is people do, that it's part of the human condition and spirit.
I tend to believe that the evolutionary psychologists who suggest that humans are in all likelihood serial monogamous are on to something. I think that the general evidence, my anecdotal evidence, what I see in the statistics would suggest that that perhaps we're more likely to be over the course of our lifetime have three or four long-term mates. It's probably true, and I think maybe what's happening is we're having those first couple of long-term mates during our extended single years, and then we finally, at age 30 or 35, or in my case, 38, finding someone to stick with for the remainder.
I think that could be very true. I think in my own family and life and friends and my own relationships, I mean, it's been that serial relationship over the years.
Right.
But the other issue I want to ask, then we'll come back to the phones, is this race has come up a number of times. Is that you think this generation of yours, 40 and under, for the most part, you know, early 40s and under, is it are these generations that these urban tribes you write about, Ethan, are these interracial urban tribes, or are the urban tribes still very separate in terms of their social interactions, especially among professionals and in their worlds? What do you both think, Ethan, and then Chris, and then we'll go back to the phones.
You know what I found, and again, this is anecdotally, but among the groups I've studied, they tended to be fairly homogenous in terms of age and income level professional attainment, and then fairly diverse. So to the extent that whatever city you were in had a diverse professional, income cohort, then you're likely to see a great deal of diversity in that group. To the extent that the city you were living in did not have that, you're likely not to see that. So they weren't. They tended just to sort of follow along a different pattern.
I'm going to answer the question from a residential segregation perspective, because I do work on residential segregation as well. Mm-hmm. And I just did a paper with John Iceland at Penn State. And what we found is that single and living alone adults are more likely to be racially integrated. They're going to live among other racial and ethnic groups than are married couples with children. So I think you have these single and living alone adults that are actually kind of pushing the envelope, and they're probably promoting more racial integration than some other kind of like household formation. And I think that's really interesting. And I would venture to say, like, with following Ethan's research, I think that is in fact the case. These urban tribes are very racially diverse. It's interesting, though, because I also do work on class, and I would just kind of like wanted to ask Ethan if there's also class diversity. If you see these urban tribes for middle class, less than middle class, and upper class.
There is not as much class diversity in these tribes, and they tend to, the reason they exist tends to be the fact that the women among them in that group, I think the social energy that sort of sustains them is that women had gone to college and gone on to real careers and have delayed marriage. So It is many of the urban tribes that I was trying to describe, and again, I was trying to do this almost as a memoir because I was trying to describe my own life.
Mm-hmm.
So you tended to see slightly less class diversity in these groups. And I think that's something that we should definitely think about. One of the reasons I began to write this book was that Robert Putnam came out with his book called Bowling Alone, which suggested that my generation of young people were not joining the social organizations that their parents belonged to, not joining the Lions Club and the League of Women Voters and doing the social good that their parents had done. And I wanted to make a case that even though we weren't doing those things, we were helping each other out. But I think Robert Putnam's argument, especially when it comes to reaching across class lines and helping people out and interacting with people from different both racial and class backgrounds, is something that is easy to not do when you're in a group of friends that you all went to college together with.
It is interesting. I think the idea that also fascinating idea is that the informal organization of friends is as much a group as the formalized groups that other people in older generations joined. Is but part of your thesis.
That is exactly part of my thesis, but I have to also come to terms with the fact that as I looked into these groups, I wanted to make the case that they were doing the same things that my parents were doing when they were involved in those social organizations, that they were really helping out the community. And indeed, these groups tend to be a little more focused inwardly. But I do think I went on to make the case that I was very influenced by a social scientist named Mark Granovetter, who made the gave us this idea of the sort of dark matter, that these groups often connected you to layers and layers of friends of friends, and that indeed people that go to an urban center and try to make a life there have to figure out very complicated social problems. And the more they can light up that secondary, not just your friends, but the friends of friends groups to gather information, to find the good job, to find the mate, to find the apartment, the more likely you will to succeed. And I began to think of these urban tribes as sort of ways to create that that dark social matter in your life. And I think once you begin to add all that up, the ways in which these tribes are interconnected, and this was, I was writing about this before Friendster and Facebook and MySpace and so forth, it came along and sort of proved my point that this generation is very interested in those what Granovetter called the strength of weak ties.
Let us go back to the phones here. And I think it's interesting, we're talking about marriages, and I was just looking this up as we were talking, that this is the oldest that any group is married in American history since the 1890s, when they were sort of taking these kind of studies and looking at it, when the average age was 21, 22 years old. Now it's up to 27. But it's interesting when you look at this in terms of the marriages around the world in your generation. And I think that in the younger generations, the median age for first marriage is high all over the world. I mean, it's in places like Iran, it's 29 years old. In places like Togo, it's 28 years old. It's not just in America or the West. This is happening across the globe.
I think that's true. And I think, the prime reason and the prime mover of that, I believe, is that women are having really viable careers, viable educational opportunities, and meaningful careers to pursue during their 20s. And once they get to the end of their 20s, they can make a choice as to whether marriage appears to be a better option than the thing they have going. These social groups that you join during your 20s tend to have momentum, and one of the most interesting things I found is that they also tend to be very jealous of outsiders that want to come in and marry away one of the central people in your group. They tend to act a little bit like the jealous lover. They don't want that person to escape the group.
Let's go back to the phones here. 410-319-8888 is the number. And Robin, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Robin.
Thanks so much for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
The conversation is fascinating. I want to bring the conversation back to an issue close to my heart, which is the dilemma of highly educated, upper middle class African American women, and the reason why we don't marry. And I speak from experience. I'm Ivy League educated and 47 years old and single, not by choice. I did make a lot of choices as a young person to pursue my education, to travel the world, to learn languages, to meet all sorts of people, and delayed the choice to settle down. I'm at the point now, though, where the market for eligible candidates appropriate for me simply isn't there. There are no men. So there is a problem of the marriage market for black women, particularly educated, upper middle class origins, et cetera. I also wanted to make the observation that in my particular urban tribe, something you haven't described is the heterogeneity of sexual orientation. My friends are incredibly diverse in terms of sexual orientation. I have many gay and lesbian friends in my particular tribe, and those relationships are as important to me as any other sort of relationship. Those friendships are valuable, meaningful, and incredibly important. So wanted to make those two observations, and thank you both so much for your work.
Thanks, Robin.
There's really interesting observations. Let's talk about those observations. I mean, is that true in both your, the second question first, but in both of your tribes, so to speak, not just gender, but in terms of sexual orientation, that it's very diverse in your worlds?
In my case, I would say fairly diverse. But I also have to say that I live in San Francisco, and you would think that would make it definitely diverse. But I think the truth in San Francisco is that the gay population was forming these groups and these friendship bonds a generation ago for the very same reasons that we did a generation later. That is, they went to move to a big city. They were going to delay marriage, and in their case, they didn't have the ability to get married at the time. They were often disconnected from their families of origin. And they do this thing that humans do, which is that in those situations, you will begin to form friendship groups that are very, very meaningful. And so our group is diverse, but, you know, the friendship groups that exist in the gay community are incredibly vibrant and meaningful. Now this is the second generation of them. So now there's perhaps third generation of them, and it's a very vibrant thing.
Chris?
I would echo the same thing that, yes, there's a lot of sexual orientation diversity in the urban tribes, especially my urban tribe. I want to go back to Robin's point, which is a question that I brought up earlier.
Her first point.
Her first point, please. About being 47, Ivy League trained, and knowing multiple languages. And she said that she definitely is in this position, this single and living alone, or the solid position by force. And it gets back to the question whether or not this really is a forced or choice position. And if it is, in fact, a forced position, how can we move more towards the way Ethan is talking about it and move towards really embracing this and telling a new story, even though it is a forced position? How can we really embrace this and make this a very positive? And I don't know exactly how black women or professional black men can do that.
So I had a question came to my mind. I'm sorry she's not on the line to answer, but she said she made that point about those relationships being every bit as important to her as her romantic relationships. And that does sort of beg the question of, can you then, if that is true, can you then come along and begin a romantic relationship with all the difficulties of getting one going? And there's always, you know, there's that great romantic period, but there's always a period that it doesn't look as great as it did. And then you're weighing it against those meaningful friendships. And my question is, do they have to compete? And my answer, to answer my own question, is often indeed they do. I don't think romantic relationships, I do think they need a time when you step away from that urban tribe group to give that, you know, to redefine who the us is in your life to just two people for a while, perhaps. And then perhaps you can go back and re-enter the group as a different type of person. But it is very difficult to have both those things going on in your life and have them gel perfectly.
But okay, Ethan, that's good that you bring that up. But here's the question then. If you go away for your romantic relationship and you come back to the urban tribe, are you now thought of as an outsider? Or are you thought of as a traitor? Or are you thought of someone who's not legitimate to the group?
I think, well, it depends on sort of when you do it. If you're the first person to do it, oftentimes people look at you and they think, you know, they think, you kind of like they look at a friend who's joined a really cult-like religion where you have to live on a guarded compound. You know, they worry about your freedom of self-expression and so forth. But what I've noticed about these groups is there tends to be a little bit of a domino effect, and that was true in my cohort, which is that I was one of the first to get married, but within 2 years there were four other marriages within the group, and suddenly marriage is the thing that everyone's doing. And the same thing then happened with children. You know, a year or two later, I was the first to have children, and then all of a sudden we have all these little rugrats running around. So you tend to sort of do these life stages together, and I think if you don't move to the suburbs and you don't, just think of your friends as, oh, those are the guys I hung out with when I was single, but you realize that that's where your social capital is, as Robert Putnam would put it, and you give it a story and you give it meaning, that you will use that group throughout your entire life, and it can survive people getting married and having children.
It's interesting. As I was listening to you all, and we don't have time to get into this now because we're almost out of time, but that the nations, especially in Europe, where marriage is delayed the most, where the average age of first marriages for men, let's say, is in their early 30s, and women in their late 20s, early 30s, are in the social democratic, more highly educated nations where people have more income equality and where people are making higher incomes. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know what that means. Maybe nothing. But it's interesting that's where that exists, even to a greater extent than here in the United States of America.
Yeah.
Well, food for thought for another day. And I want to apologize to our callers who did not get through because we only have like a minute left here. Do we have time for another call? We don't. That's my music I'm hearing, which means Brian's saying, forget it, Mark. So that's all right. Ethan Waters, thank you so much for being with us. It's been a pleasure to have you on the air.
It's been a great conversation. I very much enjoyed it.
Look forward to having you back. It's in these our Urbanite Radio Stories. It's in this issue of Urbanite. You can see the interview, his books, Urban Tribes, and the latest one, Crazy Like Us. And Dr. Chris Marsh, Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of Maryland. Great work on families, especially among African-American women. And we will have them both on, I hope, again in the future to further these discussions. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks, Ethan.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about the most. Daily content on arts, culture, food design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns today are Daniel Gillespie and Will Mason. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, find out information on our guests and their work, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.